have Mr. Foley here in person and Mr. Brown visually. Lockdown in Auckland, Mr. Brown?
Yes, we are in lockdown. Can you hear me, by the way?
Yes, loud and clear. So what's the plan? Mr. Foley, are you going to speak first?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Brown. We have your summary, Mr. Brown. So
thank you.
So I suggest you proceed.
I'll just proceed with reading perhaps from paragraph 2, Mr. Chair. The Independent Hearing Panel in Decision Report 09 from 2018 on the District Plan's residential zone stated the following after a detailed discussion of the material before it. And either I can let you work your way through that or I could just quickly paraphrase.
Why don't you paraphrase? I think we've read it before, but so you
sure.
Paraphrase
well,
better.
The Council's urban design witness was Mr. Falconer, who supported the addition of design guidelines as a support reference that could help give developers practical ideas rather than form part of a paint-by-numbers rulebook detailing a Queenstown style to be complied with. And then jumping down to the Commission's findings, and the paragraph 145, on design matters more generally, this is the second sentence, we strongly prefer that the plan continue a pragmatic, non-regulatory approach given the subjectivity of the matter. So in paragraph 3, I appreciate that this current hearing is before a different hearings panel and that unlike the 2018 panel, you have the benefit of seeing actual guidelines. However, the matters discussed by and the findings of the 2018 panel are relevant and important. This variation promotes the residential design zone design guide to be included as a restricted discretionary activity matter in the lower density residential zone and the other residential zones. The discretion is restricted to the consistency with the design guide 2019, and the council could therefore or could hence refuse an application if it is inconsistent with the guide. The guide promotes many detailed design elements, aspirations and exemplars. Imposed as a broad matter of discretion, it would be, in my view, a paint-by-numbers rulebook, in Mr. Falconer's language, and not a support reference that could help give developers practical ideas. The design guide would not be a pragmatic, non-regulatory approach in the 2018 panel's language. I agree with the approach preferred by the 2018 panel and therefore do not support the inclusion of the design guide in the form promoted in this variation as a regulatory RDA method. However, I see a role for the design guide as a support reference that could help give developers practical ideas in a pragmatic, non-regulatory way, again using Mr. Falconer's and the 2018 panel's language. This role would be achieved simply by inclusion of a new clause in the zone as follows. It will be under 7.3, which is other provisions and rules, and 7.3.4 would be for non-regulatory methods. Applicants are encouraged to consider the Queensland Lakes District Council's residential zone design guide for practical assistance in designing developments. This method would provide a signal to applicants that the design guide exists as a tool to assist in design, reflect that the design guide is, in my view, a well-considered and presented document which could assist applicants, avoid a scenario where an otherwise well-designed development that does not meet one or more of the detailed design elements in the design guide would not face the prospect of refusal because of that inconsistency, and complement the existing well-known and utilised methods, including obtaining an expert urban design report to support a particular development proposal, noting that the objectives and policies and matters of discretion would readily authorise a council officer to request such an assessment if one is not provided by an applicant and is considered by the officer necessary to assist in the determination of the application, and or engaging with the council's urban design panel, which acts as in a peer review role and, in my experience, offers practical advice and feedback on development proposals and is a valuable resource for applicants, council officers and decision makers. To reiterate my view on Section 7 of the Act, it is more efficient to identify the minimum standards for development as rules within the zone, as decided through Stage 1 of the proposed plan review, without imposing additional de facto standards and discretion via a separate document. and the Section 32 evaluation has not demonstrated that the current objectives, policies and rules, as determined by the 2018 panel, are adversely affecting amenity values or the quality of the environment. The residentially zoned land in the district is a limited resource, and development of these should be enabled as efficiently as possible. Accordingly, I consider that the design guide should not play a regulatory role, but can play a supporting non-regulatory role as a practical guide to applicants. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer questions now, or you may wish to hear from Mr. Foley, and we can both answer questions.
Well, perhaps if you're suggesting that, we will hear from Mr. Foley. Mr. Foley, you have a two-page text.
Thank you. I appreciate that you've only just received this document, so I'm assuming, Mr. Chairman, you're happy for me to more or less walk my way through it.
Please do.
So I've been in Queenstown 27 years. I've got a background in contributing to our community, previously chair of the Historic Places Trust local branch that was just after I'd restored ICARTS. On the urban design panel in its very early days, Duncan Field asked that I be one of four on a committee to review the delivery of RMA services when I guess Civic Corp was at a contentious stage and there was a groundswell to bring it back to council. I'm currently the chair of the Wakatuba High School Foundation I own a building company in Queenstown and have completed several residential developments of my own. They've all been in the, not directly in the CBD, but in that surrounds up on those hills. And currently, amongst the work that I am doing, is a property located at the bottom of Fern Hill, a 5-hectare block with a low density res classification but visitor accommodation overlay. So my view of a guide is just that it's intended to assist people with coming up with productive outcomes that align with values that our community might have, but I don't agree that they're necessarily enshrined in our district plan. And as Mr. Brown's pointed out, these guides are effectively being promoted as rules covering all residential zones. And when you look at the breadth of that, the residential zones are a huge quantum in any description. The sites all have different attributes. They all face different ways. Designs are done to recognise that the receiving environment in its wider context. And purchasers buy these properties with desires and tastes of their own. For the large part, engage professional designers and consultants to help them to meet the current regulatory framework. So I don't think there's too many that would simply roll up at the moment, apart from perhaps a new shed under the latest changes. It would roll up with their own drawings without having engaged some level of design or professional assistance. The areas that do have design controls, such as Arrowtown, where I live, and the Queenstown CBD, they're quite different from the residential context. You've got sensitivity around typology and character, strong heritage elements. The residential areas this guide covers are already populated by a huge range of architectural styles. They are reflective of the periods in which they were built, the economy of the time, the types of materials that were available, people's own intentions. So what we're proposing here is that this guide document, which I agree with Mr. Brown, is a good document, become design rules. It enables any application to be turned down if an applicant doesn't follow those rules, and it is at the behest of the planners or authority at the time. I do believe it is putting us into a straitjacket where we have to follow the guidebook and tick all the boxes. It's going to stymie innovation. It's going to, to some extent around social engineering. I've seen that before. I appreciate your time is short. I've seen a 2,000 person building in Christchurch that I put together as part of as a project where they had four car parks. That was because of the belief that cars shouldn't be there. 2,000 people right next to A&E. So as a property developer, I've strived to complete projects that complement the qualities of a site and that context of environment. I employ design consultants and I pay a lot of money for them to design projects that we value both in the built form and, of course, for an economic outcome. So we're now supposed to co-design these projects with the QLDC planning team and their independent contractor consultants that are now engaged to review a significant number of the applications. And I'm sure the panel is aware of the level of delegation that goes out to independent consultants to assist the authority to meet its obligations under RMA and to try and get their delivery model to work. I think we should be able to submit applications and designs of our own making. But clearly, if you don't show respect for the current district plan, then you fail. And I don't plan on changing that or suggesting that we change that. So who is the most qualified? The landowner and his or her architect and consulting team, or planners handling 30 or 40 applications each? And respectfully, a lot of whom only have a few years' experience. I think it can work, the design guide can work well in recognising limitations of non-designers, as I mentioned, people that just roll up without having necessarily done a suitable amount of investigation and design work. But it's almost like this document is overlaying everybody rather than, and perhaps heading for the lowest common denominator, rather than acknowledging the standard of a lot of the applications that the council does receive. So just how would such a wide-ranging document work in practice? Other than to provide council planners with this wide level of discretion over developers, we would struggle to rely on the plan as a reference point for compliance. I don't think that the current process is a particularly easy one. I think there are a number of hurdles that need to be satisfied, and often they come out through those delegations that they currently work with. And I just don't think it needs to be any more onerous. The planning department works under a significant workload, and that's been prevalent for many years. I'm not sure just how they would resource up to appropriately respond to this additional overlay of a guide, which isn't a guide, it's actually a set of rules. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Throw a question in your direction, Mr. Brown.
Yes.
In the passages you've quoted both from Mr. Faulkner's evidence and from the panel report, it seems to me that the panel thought there was value in having a design guideline. You said that the notified policy and the attached method is not necessary to achieve the higher order provisions.
Do you think there is value? Do you share that view of the panel at stage one, that it may not be necessary, but there is value in having guidelines, putting aside what role they have?
Yes, I do agree with that. And I suggested there in my summary, effectively at paragraph 8, that there's a role, they would provide a signal to applicants and so on, and complement the other methods available, and that inclusion in one way or another, but as a non-regulatory method, is preferable. And that's my view, and I think that reflects the earlier panel's view, where they recorded that they strongly prefer that the plan continue a pragmatic non-regulatory approach. So to answer your question, yes, there's room for the guidelines, just not in the manner in which they're being brought into the plan as a result of this variation.
Understanding that, is there an argument that it's desirable to have some level of regulation to the extent of requiring applicants to confirm that they have actually considered the guidelines and identified what elements of their design responds to them without having the overlay of a requirement to be consistent with them?
Well, we've got objectives and policies and matters of discretion that already require that applicants provide details of, in a restricted discretionary environment, provide details about maintaining amenity values in the residential zone and so on. So there's already a level of imposition there anyway that can be adopted by the planning officer and any other consultants involved in processing the application. I think there could be room, as long as it's under your suggestion, doesn't require a tick box exercise where an applicant has to go through every component of the guidelines to demonstrate how they're met or how they're not met, and if they're not met, why not, which seemed to be the focus of the amended, I'll just try and find, statement about what the status of the guide is, which is in paragraph 6.6 of Mr. Devlin's rebuttal evidence. And that revised status, which changes it from being a matter under section 104.1c to something else, but it's still a matter that would have to be considered under 104. It's still going to require the applicant to work through all of the components of the guideline. Even though it says that it's not intended to be assessed in terms of compliance, but rather whether a proposal has addressed the good design elements promoted by the design guide. Bringing that back to your question, your suggestion is that there is something in the plan? Would it be a policy or an objective or a matter of discretion that still requires the applicant to demonstrate how they're complying or not with the design guide?
That wasn't what I had in mind. What I had in mind was an information requirement. Confirm that you've considered the guidelines and tell us what you have done to respond to them. Stop.
And that's not in a... That would be in an advice note form?
I think I was envisaging something a little more regulatory than an advice note, but as an information requirement on applications.
I think that will be all right. I'm just seeing if that's how different it is from my suggestion in my paragraph 7 of my statement, where applicants are encouraged to consider for practical assistance in designing developments. Your suggestion goes one step slightly further than that by requiring applicants to at least have looked at it and have some sort of statement as to how they've responded to it. That still, in my view, like my suggestion, avoids the problem I identified in paragraph 8C, which is the scenario where an otherwise well-designed development would be refused because of an inconsistency with the plan, which is the biggest issue for me. So yes, I could live with your suggestion. So it's still effectively a non-regulatory method because the officer wouldn't have the grounds, the discretion to refuse an application for any particular inconsistency with the design guide, if I've understood your suggestion.
Although I didn't know what Mr. Foley was going to suggest, it seems to me that you want to pick up people who are going to try and do it themselves and who will mess it up.
Sir, what I was suggesting is that these guides would be of most assistance to those kind of applicants that need that guidance with how they might go about preparing to lodge an application. But it's not, sir, but this document is one that is enshrined and captures every applicant and straitjackets applications rather than assisting those that may need it.
I understand that. Commissioner Munro, do you have any questions?
Just one question of Mr. Brown. I'm interested in exploring sort of the same theme raised by the Chair, and that's particularly something in the middle ground between what the Council's sought, which is full discretion and a pretty prescriptive looking document, to at the other end of the spectrum, the complete hands-off that you've specifically referred to, where the guidelines are just something to look at if you're interested. And I'm wondering about your thoughts on, if I go through these guidelines, what I'm taking as the key issues are the titles of those design elements. And so, for instance, one of them I'm looking at now is connections to open space, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a middle ground where a design discretion could be put in the plan that related to those design elements as just general topics, without then referring to the guideline as the way to do it? Clearly, if someone wanted to look at them as one example of how to deal with it, they could, if they had their own view. Though the plan wouldn't be saying it must be like the guideline does, it would just be talking about that particular design element.
Thank you, Commissioner Munro. Yeah, I I think that's a reasonable suggestion. We're in a restricted discretionary environment anyway. Mm. We're in an environment where an expert urban design report is likely to be in, required, either commissioned by the applicant or required by the council. Typically, that design report would focus on best practice urban design and hence would be focusing on the matters which are effectively the themes of the design guide now. So on that basis, yes, I could support something along the lines of what you've suggested as a middle road.
Yeah, thank you. The reason I ask about that middle road is that certainly the experience I've had as a decision maker in the context of design guidelines that are completely up to the applicant is that you only ever hear about them when an applicant thinks they've got some bits to pick out of it to help them make the argument why they should be able to get exempted from some other plan requirements, and they never ever talk about it when there's a shortfall. And so I'm not really convinced as a completely standalone document they're going to be particularly helpful. But you might have a different perspective and experience on that, and your thoughts on that would be pretty welcome. Well, sounds like you've got none. That's fine too.
No, I'm just trying to think of the instances where design guidelines have been used, and they are used, as Mr. Foley indicated, for where there is an issue to be addressed, a character issue, for example, like Arrowtown. Arrowtown has a historic heart, and there are design guidelines to protect the amenities of that, a particular issue. Same with Queenstown, the historic part of Queenstown, where design guidelines apply there, but not to other parts of downtown Queenstown. And Wanaka Town Centre has its own design guide as well for the what has emerged as that downtown character of Wanaka. So I can see a role for design guides in a regulatory sense where there is a real character type issue. The other instances where there are design guidelines are where they're simply imposed by a developer because a developer wants to actually create a particular environment in a new, say, greenfields area. For example, Jack's Point has got some. Where there is... I'm not then sure, because I haven't had much experience in areas which don't have some sort of special character like the Queenstown residential zones.
Okay,
so that's about as far as I can take that
all
question.
Right. I'm going to stop there.
Commissioner McLeod.
A couple of points, if I may, is I would be interested in your view because I'm looking at the design guidelines and I was looking for something quite aspirational. Everyone's got to meet the building code. You've highlighted the point that you're in an RD environment and you would have a design report, which you'd be looking at best practice. Is there scope for encouragement to improve on best practice, to be aspirational? And if there is scope for that, do you think that these design guidelines offer that?
Is that directed to me? I'll kick off on that. Yes, I think if they're promoting something aspirational, I agree with you. To the extent of the solutions that have been put to me by Commissioner Robinson and Commissioner Munro, but not to the extent that it becomes a full restricted discretionary matter.
And just thinking in terms of the way we're heading with regards to climate change, the way we're heading with regard to carbon footprint, there doesn't seem to be a lot of guideline pushing that. And I was just wondering if this, if there is scope within the guidelines to potentially review, encourage. I'd be interested in your professional opinion of it.
Yes, it can do those things. I don't have any problem with that. To steer people in the direction of what we could call sustainable design.
Or even renewable design.
Yes. I'm comfortable with the guidelines having provisions which seek to do those things.
Commissioner Hill.
Nothing for me, thank you.
Commissioner Dawson.
No, nothing more for me, thanks.
Commissioner Smith.
No, thank you.
Well, thank you very much to you both for your time and for your input.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. While we're waiting to hand out the paper, somebody here for the Arthurs Point Protection Society? I think you're number one to go after the Breen team. Appreciate you sitting waiting patiently for us.
I'm here to assist with the submissions from a bunch of submitters that I think you've got scheduled now, which include the Breen team. Is that okay? Yeah, it's on. Right. So, submitters, actually, I'll go through the list if you like. First up is going to be Mr. Rowley, which is submitted 3266 and further submitted 3450. Then Mr. Breen's going to follow, and he has submissions 3234 and 3235, and further submission 3453. Then Mr. Phil Smith will follow, his primary submission 3286 and further submission 3454. And then Mr. Ackland, his primary submission 3300 and further submissions 3452 and 3455. So
is there a statement from Mr. Ackland?
No, you don't. He's just here to answer questions. And then I've got my summary statement to read out as well. So I'm in your hands, but if you'd like, I'm happy to read my summary statement first and then invite the submitters up to read their summaries, if that suits.
If that's how you'd like to proceed, Mr. Edmonds, please.
And then they'll be all here to answer questions of the panel as you work through. So my name is John Bernard Edmonds. I adopt the evidence of Hayley Mann for the submitters above as my own. And unfortunately, Ms. Mann can't be here today because of a family matter. I consider that the most appropriate zoning for the notified general industrial zone at Ballantyne Road to be a modified GIZ with a modification to allow for commercial, office, and I would actually suggest trade retail activities that are not ancillary to industrial service use. This is similar to the current industrial A zoning under the operative district plan, which would allow for the continuation of the existing mix of light industrial and non-industrial uses in the area. As described in Ms. Hampson's evidence, most activities within the GIZ at Ballantyne Road are light industrial or office or service activities with only four industrial and two yard-based industrial activities. Light industrial and industrial activities make up less than 30% of the predominant activities occurring in the Ballantyne Road Industrial A area. Additionally, it's noted that there is sufficient capacity in the short, medium and long term for industrial-based activities. Mr. Place has relied on Strategic Policy 338, which is to avoid non-industrial activities occurring in areas zoned as industrial, to in turn justify the prohibited activity status for non-industrial activities. The true nature of the ODP industrial A zone has resulted in an area that is not industrial. This is evidenced by the lack of control in the ODP of rules of any particular kind of activity except for retail over a certain size and limits on residential flats and the resulting lack of industrial activities in the area. In short, even though the ODP zoning is named Industrial A, it is not a true industrial area, and so Strategic Policy 338 would not be able to be given effect to. The imposition of a prohibited activity status for non-industrial activities, with no provision for expansion of existing non-industrial activities, in an area which will largely include service, commercial, light industrial and residential natures, will restrict the ability of existing activities to expand and to attract new tenants, given the existing use rights test under Section 10 is so difficult to meet. This will impose a large economic cost on landlords who have invested in their sites, in part on reliance of the existing flexibility that the ODP industrial zoning allows. I consider that there are more appropriate sites for council to direct their imposition of a strict industrial zoning, such as a Cromwell. And if the QLDC had completed their future development strategy as they were supposed to by September 2018 under the NPS urban development capacity, then new areas for strict industrial sites may be able to be considered. Additionally, I consider that the Bunnings case and the NPS urban development directs us to consider Cromwell when looking at suitability of land for industrial purposes. A modified GIZ allowing for office, commercial and trade retail activities is the most appropriate zone because it will assist in the diversification of the district's economic base and creation of employment opportunities, which is consistent with Strategic Policy 3216, as compared to a strict industrial zone. Strategic Objective 323 is a direction towards a quality built environment taking into account the character of the community. As the current industrial A zoning has resulted in a mixed-use area, the quality of the built environment should be improved on the basis of its existing use rather than reverting to a strict industrial built environment. I do not consider that allowing the continuation of commercial, office and trade retail activities in the Ballantyne Road area is going to undermine the primacy of the Wanaka Town Centre due to the types of commercial, retail and office activities which gravitate to the different areas and different target markets. As covered in Ms. Mahn's evidence, the best zoning outcome of the area is an amended GIZ to allow for office, commercial and trade retail activities which are not ancillary to industrial activities, as it will allow the already existing activities occurring in this area to continue and expand, making use of the infrastructure which has already been invested in by the landowners. An amended GIZ would allow council to continue to provide for industrial activities whilst balancing the effects of other activities using the reverse sensitivity provisions proposed in the GIZ. This option is the most appropriate in terms of Section 5 and continuing to allow people to provide for their economic well-being whilst avoiding adverse effects of activities. Overall, I consider a modified GIZ to be more similar to the industrial A zoning in the operative plan and to be much more appropriate in terms of the existing activities taking place whilst also allowing for the development and expansion of existing businesses, whilst also still providing for industrial uses to occur. I consider the modified GIZ can be provided regardless of Strategic Policy 338 because the true existing nature of the area notified as GIZ zoning around Ballantyne Road and Gordon Road is not industrial. So that's my summary statement. I'll leave it with you, sir, as to whether you want questions of me now or as part of the...
I think we should hear from your clients first.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'll invite up Mr. Rowley.
Good afternoon. My name is... You happy for me to say?
Absolutely. Roll on.
My name is Jerry Rowley. I was born and raised on Lake Hawi Station. My grandfather pioneered that property when it was carved off the enormous Morven Hills Station in 1910. Excuse me. I went to school with the children of the early transport families, the Staffords, whose yard was on Camp Hill Road, which is Hawi Flat, the Reeds, whose yard was in the main street of Luggett, and the McLeods, whose yard was on Warren Street, just around the corner from the top of Helwick Street. These eventually amalgamated to become Upper Clutha Transport Company that we all know today. The yard on Warren Street, which hitherto was on the outskirts of town, became swallowed up by expanding residential development, and so they moved way out of town to Ballantyne Road. And I understand that they're looking to move on again now to further away, which it seems logical. As the pace of development now accelerates at a blistering pace, it is becoming apparent to those with an eye for it that Ballantyne Road is becoming less and less appropriate for this kind of industry, such as Warren Street did all those years ago. Placemakers has been in four different premises since its arrival in Wanaka in the 70s. Firstly, Lower Howick Street, then an Upper Ardmore Street, then Anderson Road before moving to Ballantyne Road in 2006. With each shift, the use of land behind changed to something more intensive, less industrial. This is the natural way of things, progress, as some would say. In the same way, but without an alternative area to move to, many businesses on Ballantyne Road, Frederick Street and Gordon Road now reflect a wide mix of use as high land values and exorbitant leases squeeze people out of the downtown area. Many of the lot sizes in this area also make it more conducive to mixed use rather than a very restrictive GIZ as it is proposed. In my opinion, exclusive GIZ should have its own designated area out of town and off busy thoroughfares.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rowley.
keep rolling through this notice here? Sure. Okay, so next is Mr. John Breen.
My name is John Breen. I represent the owners of 92 Ballantyne Road, lot 2DP 26235. The Breen Construction Company, incorporated in Invercargill 30 August 1939, is the tenant of the property, which was purchased by the J.C. Breen Family Trust from Peter Gordon in 2000. Breen Co., contracting in Central Otago from the company's inception, has maintained a presence in the Wanaka Upper Clutha district since at least as far back as 1987, when new base facilities for Treble Cone Ski Field Limited were constructed. An extensive list of commercial builds of all types and sizes have followed and continue to do so as I write. The current premises on the property were constructed under a resource consent granted 31 July 2001. The consent drawings for that first initiative showed a proposed administrative building which was not built. The point being that since day one in Wanaka, the family has had the necessity of administrative accommodation in mind on this site. And in this respect, that time is now upon us. Currently, including managers and designers, Breen Co. has a growing company workforce of in excess of 30 people, including at this point something of a minimal number of administrative, management and technical staff based in Wanaka. We now have resource consents under the ODP that allow the trust to progress various options which allow up to four separate two-storey office buildings. But the limiting changes and differing prospects presented by the current PDP make for uncertainty, revalues, and long-term marketability. There has been considerable cost in having to second-guess the options in an attempt to secure future potential that might well, in the event of the PDP as it exists at this point becoming fact, evaporate. The in question southwest and northeast aspects of Ballantyne Road are, as existing today, of a well-established mixed-use nature. And to be blunt, it seems to me that no amount of paper makeover can hide the obvious. That is, the zoning of this land needs to reflect its current state and usage. Any attempt to make it otherwise can only amount to a further waste of valuable time and resource better expended in productive enterprise coming, by and large, within existing parameters. Clearly also there are enterprises other than that which I represent who voice similar concern around the same questions in Ballantyne Road and other close by localities identified in the JE&A submissions, John Edmonds and Associates, that stands for. The design of the consented office accommodations will be highly visible from Ballantyne Road. The stylish structure and exterior cladding intended to exclusively feature New Zealand-grown timbers. The point being that it is difficult to imagine a better site upon which to visibly and innovatively illustrate the use of homegrown natural materials. Sites such as this are surely a critical part of this evolving new Wanaka gateway, and high quality designs reflecting the existing use and purpose of the area, and which as such take the eye, should be valued, not prohibited. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Breen. Now, Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon.
Can you use the microphone for the so you're recorded?
Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Phil Smith. For the past 40 years, I've been enjoying all Wanaka has to offer. For 20 years, I've been a permanent resident of the town. In that time, I've watched the township of Wanaka grow from what I consider to have been a small holiday village into the vibrant town we see today. I grew up with a construction industry background, and I've been lucky to have been employed or had ownership in businesses that have enjoyed growth. I stand here today for two reasons. Number one, I've spent time in or lived permanently in Wanaka for the majority of my lifetime. I've raised my three children here and enjoyed the outdoors and all the town has to offer. For 20 years, I've engaged in business here that has connected me to the downtown and to the Ballantyne Road areas. With either hat on, I can't for the life of me see any sense in what's being proposed. It's nothing but a backward step. From a resident's perspective, how can it be practical to promote heavy industrial near schools, recreation centres, sports fields, retirement villages and residential developments? In my opinion, this proposed general industrial zone contradicts existing council vision and plans, specifically Beyond Vision 2050, and the current 10-year plan. As councillors are well aware, council has adopted in partnership with citizens a community-owned, overarching vision for our district's long-term future. Beyond Vision 2050, you along with your elected member colleagues unanimously agreed in March 2019 to commit to the vision as a guiding document to inform future decision-making and planning. So let's use it here. Does this proposed general industrial zone align with its principles? I personally think not. The first vision statement of Vision 2050 is thriving people. Ours is a community with a strong heart and whānau roots that run deep. Translating this to how we live, work and play in the land available to us means protecting as much land as possible to live, work and play in. Not to shut down these possibilities so close to town, schools, and houses. Another vision statement of Vision 2050 is breathtaking creativity. Surrounded by the endless inspiration of our landscapes, ours is a place that nurtures the arts, culture, and the spirit of invention. I shouldn't have to state the obvious, that by any objective measure, heavy industrial activity does not lend itself to inspiring, breathtaking creativity. Another obvious contradiction can be found when considering Vision 2050's desire to hear the deafening dawn chorus. Our ecosystems flourish and are predator-free under our guardianship. Trucks rumbling up and down Ballantyne Road and loud machinery would drown out the drive away birds, their song, and other flora and fauna. Our current 10-year plan has prioritised the concept of active transport, allocating funds to support an increase in walking and cycleways, making safety a priority on roads throughout the region. This decision was made based on extensive community feedback expressing concern about increasing traffic, and in particular, safety for our children commuting to schools, including the new school in Three Parks. Safety is not the first word that comes to mind when I picture trucks and machinery coexisting with pedestrians, cyclists, and school children. The district plan is an important level of influence on future planning. It enables certain kinds of growth and activity that support our community values and protect us from growth and activity that could damage our land or our people. In your decision about this particular aspect of the PDP, I urge you to heed what our community has clearly communicated about what it values for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and the land they will take guardianship of in decades ahead. From a business perspective, I would suggest that the growth has put a strain on certain businesses to operate downtown. Parking is extremely limited and rents are high. For nearly 10 years, I operated a project management, design and build construction business out of Brownston House at 21 Brownston Street. While there is a council car park located right beside the building, it's now become near impossible to park after 7:30 a.m. And once you leave it, you don't get it back. Running a business under these conditions is extremely challenging, and for that reason, and the fact that many businesses don't need to be located on or near the waterfront in high rent areas, we need mixed business zones to move to and grow. For this reason, in 2017, I designed with local architects Condon Scott an office building for 86 Ballantyne Road. The concept was to provide businesses an opportunity to freehold own an office building and invest in their futures. This building was issued a resource consent in 2017 and a building consent in 2018. My neighbour to the south, Mr. John Breen, has even more recently recognised the need for such offices, and Council has as recently as 2020 issued resource consents for this. Both buildings are designed to a high standard. They are both in high profile areas of Ballantyne Road. They are also totally appropriate locations for such businesses. They provide significant parking and access, and I believe aesthetically will significantly enhance the streetscape as compared to heavy industrial use promoted by council. The fact that we can proceed with our buildings is comforting, but the fact that they may be limited to type of tenant frustrating and unreasonable. You only have to look at what's already made use of the current zoning to see that there is a significant demand for architects, engineers, vets, IT centres, florists, retail and project management space that is far from practical to be in town or on the lakefront. With these developments approved for consent, but not yet completed, I feel it's valid to state that when you look at Ballantyne Road we have today, we are not looking at the Ballantyne Road of tomorrow. In less than 5 years' time, these major buildings will be in place and with very little road frontage left, and the industrial use you seem to wish to promote, already looking for more appropriate locations, it seems to me that council have dropped the ball in identifying an appropriate area for heavy industrial to locate. I strongly urge you to consider the type of business you wish to promote, the demand and the actual need for that type of business close to town. Ballantyne Road is already mixed-use business with a bit of service and industrial. If anything, promote that and provide heavy industrial activity land in an out-of-town location. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Edmonds, there's obviously a lot of overlap in Ms. Mann's evidence for these clients as for the Bush Creek people. I propose that we'll hold over questions on those elements of the evidence until later in the afternoon when you talk to Bush Creek.
Sure.
Mr. Ackland?
Oh, I was just wondering if I could speak and say that I was going to at first.
Please be brief. I'm looking at my watch. You asked for 20 minutes and it's already 25.
It's a very short scribble and I'll probably get it all wrong. So my current tenant on 15 Gordon Road is a gym. There's another gym also on the same road. There's coffee carts, there's two breweries. And these businesses, some of them I've spoken to personally and have tried to look for other places to go, more appropriate zoning, such as three parks, but the rents are extraordinary. These businesses don't exist in the new zoning that you're prescribing. So I also recently had my building for sale or lease over the last 5 weeks. I did not have any inquiries from any heavy industrial businesses. I had inquiries from arts hubs and watering systems and light industrial type uses. So I don't see where the people are going to come for this zoning. I also am part of a business called Montreal, which is a Wanaka business. We have 50 staff, well, before COVID, and we were looking for a space where we could have 50 staff growing to 100 staff. There simply isn't the zoning available for that kind of business. We talk about diversifying the economy, yet what's being prescribed here is turning it into a two-zone cookie cutter, which will create a very boring town of the future. We need different places for different people to get a start and start some new businesses, and that's not going to happen in three parks. It's going to happen in zoning as it changes over time. That's all for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. Thank you for all that. It's I know most of you, and it's interesting to hear the stories that you've come across in this area. One of the things that we've discussed over the last few days and earlier in the hearings a month or so ago was around, I suppose, the residential component of mixed business use, and it seems that the mixed business use zone certainly has a tendency towards a residential and visitor accommodation environment that I think it's fair to say that some concerns been expressed about. So, you know, I think there's some sympathy for the argument you're making that other activities need to be accommodated in these areas, but without allowing for those residential activities to also make it would be unfortunate, I think, well, potentially unfortunate for some of these sites to be taken up by apartment buildings, for instance, rather than office buildings or service activities. So I just wondered whether you've got a view on how to deal with that.
We discussed this before the hearing, so hopefully I can speak for everyone. Please tell me if I can't. But the general tenor of the owner's position is focused on business and not on visitor accommodation, not on residential. And the retail is probably more at the trade retail end of the spectrum, so that doesn't compete with the town centre. But you can hear there's need for offices, commercial, trade retail. And trade retail, I think, is of varying sizes too. It's not just placemakers. It can be pretty small operators as well that want to grow. So that's the general feel of the group.
Okay. And so if there was either a change of provisions or another zone that enabled data activities but didn't go down the extent to which business mixed use went down, you'd be comfortable with that?
Yeah.
Okay. You've referred a number of times to what you call trade retail, and I took sort of particular note of that because that's not how the plan defines it or refers to it. Is there a reason you chose that term or as opposed to the way the plan deals with it?
So at the moment the plan talks about either retail or trade supplier.
Yep.
And trade supplier was a term that came out of Plan Change 19, and that was trying to capture that range of typically larger footprint businesses that had no home in the CBD and but often needed a reasonably high profile location, such as on an arterial or collector route. I've been looking at that definition of trade supplier. I think it's what we're talking about is more than just Mr. Rowley's got a trade supplier placemaker.
Trade retail.
Yeah. But we're talking about maybe modifying a term that might fit more. And if we're talking about a business zone rather than business mixed use, because I think mixed use is dragging in the residential and visitor accommodation, which kind of works in Gorge Road, but probably doesn't work here, then it might also need a definition around trade retail that enables that mixed activities that don't directly
understand
compete
that.
With town.
So the question then remains, have you proposed a definition of trade retail, and is there scope for us to consider that?
Well, I'm reasonably comfortable with the definition of trade supplier, and maybe that needs to be slightly tweaked, or slightly amended to enable. Trade supplier has the connotation of being a very large footprint activity, and you wouldn't want to be unintentionally restricted.
It's not lost on me that the old business zone, not the current one, but the old business zone that existed, had specific provisions for what they call vehicle-oriented retail or above 250 square metres as the threshold to avoid taking those things away from the town centre. Do you see those sort of restrictions in order to protect the integrity of the town centre as useful?
In my experience, those types of rules can be very problematic at an enforcement level. People often game the system and, you know, will tell you there's a 50 square metre retail space. And unless the council's out there measuring it every week, it's a really difficult one to... I mean, this is a difficult territory to try and find the right mix of definitions and activities, but...
The obvious one to me was that a particular fruit and veggie supplier that called itself a wholesaler but was clearly a retailer, that in order to get around those rules, is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, that's right.
We've had some discussion around the council's planner has proposed what he calls the Three Parks business zone on some of those areas adjoining Tim Wallace Drive, so that the bits directly on Tim Wallace Drive will be mixed business use, the bits just beyond that would be Three Parks business zone. And we've had some discussion about whether the provisions of that zone would be applicable in other areas. And I suppose in place of the old industrial A zone. Is that something you've given any thought to?
Might have to ask the other submitters here. I haven't looked at that zone in detail, so I can't tell you off the top of my head, but certainly a business zone, I think, is the collective view of what more appropriate along Ballantyne Road.
Are you talking, Quinton, about the purple that runs down Sutton Wallace Drive and borders, say, Ballantyne Road? Is that...
Yeah, well, the purple on the Tim, and we don't have the current plan up there, this is the notified version. The one that has subsequently been accepted by the council planners as a variation on that. So that the red zone on Tim Wallace Drive would extend all the way to Ballantyne Road, and the bits of purple on either side of that would then become this Three Parks business zone as a separate thing. So there's no longer any proposed industrial zone on the Three Parks side of Ballantyne Road. At that end?
I accept
we haven't looked at the detail, but it sounds like in principle that concept is supported, so I won't...
Yeah, I think the main core of our argument is that Ballantyne Road in particular, you know, should be certainly treated as non-heavy industrial, and certainly Gordon Road has already gone down a path of far from that. And, you know, I think we also support a less weighted version of heavy industrial, you know, pretty much throughout that whole area, including the Tussock Rise piece that... you know, we fail to see that there would be reason to have a sawmill, for instance, in the middle of a residential area between a residential and a retirement village. So, that's
right. And just one last question, probably for John, just around the use of prohibited activity statuses in the GIZ proposed zone. How do you view that? Is that, I suppose, consistent with how the plan has worked in the past?
I would tend to look at a prohibited activity status as almost a case of last resort. It's a pretty extreme measure when you can't even apply for a resource consent, and remembering that this planning framework will sit around here for at least 10 years, I think it's entirely inappropriate in this instance.
Do you think it's just one last
That was
question.
The last question, wasn't
it? Yes, it is. One very last one. Does it create some difficulties in terms of the receiving environment, particularly in Gordon Road, when you have existing activities that are then become prohibited?
Yep. And that's where you end up down that existing use right pathway, which I think is referenced several times in different reports. Personal experience with existing use rights is that it's exceptionally difficult to prove and to convince the council officers of. And I think, you know, in terms of administrative costs, that's completely unnecessary.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have. But thank you for your time.
Commissioner Dawson.
Just for Mr. Edmonds, is the area of land that your group of misses relates to, the one shown in figure one in Ms. Mann's evidence?
Effectively down Ballantyne Road.
So who, tell me, I mean, at the moment she's got various red areas along Gordon Road, that's the top one, isn't it? Down Ballantyne Road, both sides, right to the below Enterprise Drive, south of Enterprise Drive.
Effectively along Gordon Road, 15 Gordon Road,
well,
Mr. Ackland.
So, let's just back up a wee bit. Are you saying that the submissions that your group of clients seek changes over are a series of individual sites?
No.
So what is the area that these submissions cover?
If anything, it's north of Frederick Street.
North of Frederick Street,
yeah.
Okay, all the way up to Gordon Road, and then along Gordon Road?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, okay, and on the west side of Ballantyne Road?
Correct.
Yes, so Gordon Road.
That's the capture area.
Yes, all right, thank you very much.
Mr. Munro?
No, thank you.
Mr. McLeod?
Planners tend to get carried away with descriptors, but if I was to see. Sorry, sitting next to our planner is probably right. But the...
yes, choose your words.
If you were to phrase this in a... Because this will be traversed with the planning regime. But if you looked at... there's been a phrase about Wanaka becoming a place where talent wants to live. Ballantyne Road would be the place where talent does business. And what an addendum to that is if there's no industrial here, where does it go?
Can I ask Mr. Ackland to respond to that?
I'm happy to add to it. Which particular bit?
Both.
Where talent lives. Well, talent will congregate in an area together, but I mean our Montreal business, you have to start in a cheap area. We started in a bedroom, and then we moved into a $120 square metre office. You're not going to get a business starting up and creating a dynamic hub if you're asked to pay $3 rent. I'm not sure if that's a complete curveball of an answer, but...
So where do you put the industrial zone?
Is industrial Wanaka's future?
I think industrial... Like, if you look at... For example, in the area you're discussing, there's two concrete batching plants.
Yeah.
Now, they exist. They're part of the existing baseline environment, and I would define that as industrial use of that site. Talent and industry is one of its future, but everyone needs a place to live.
Yeah, I think the Upper Clutha is already looking somewhere else, which I'll leave.
Yeah, we understand Upper Clutha. You've already heard from them. Rather than maybe making new businesses that are generally appropriate in this locality have to walk the tightrope of existing use rights, I think you might almost find that it's more appropriate to look at your batching plant and say, well, maybe that's the one that needs to look at the existing use rights to stay there. I think that probably is looking more towards the future rather than trying to go backwards, which is where our collective view is.
Glad we got there in the end.
You asked the planner a question.
Commissioner Hill?
Just a couple of quick questions from me, and read to Mr. Edmonds. I know the relief is, as I said, you had sort of two reliefs. One is across the whole zone, make it more liberal in terms of those activities which are not ancillary. And also the map that Commissioner Dawson pointed out is kind of effectively put a different type of zone in place. And I understand all that and what you're asking, and I think a number of submitters are saying that the GIZ zone is far too strict. But I want to come to that strategic policy on about avoid non-industrial activities, not ancillary to industrial, which you have addressed. And you said we can effectively put that aside because the area is already developed quite significantly for other activities. And contrary to Ms. Mann's evidence for Bush Creek, which is that we can go back and change those or not, I don't think we can, but one of the options has been put. What's your view if there was effectively a carve-out for those activities already existing to allow them to essentially continue, but on a better footing than an existing use right argument?
I don't think that's the ideal outcome. I think that's really a second best outcome. I think the ideal, and if you're looking to hold on to your policy of avoid non-industrial activities.
I don't think we can change it. It's much more on point for you.
I understand that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking that the suggestion maybe of Commissioner Smith and Dawson may be that there is a carve-out, that maybe there is part of this area is actually set aside as business. And we do go back to what Commissioner Smith said earlier, which was that there used to be a business zone, and used to have some flexibility to allow those emerging businesses to pop up, some trade-related type of retail to occur. And that can also start to respond to the frontage of Ballantyne Road. You've got some quite high-quality buildings on the eastern side and some consents for high-quality buildings on the western side. And that becomes quite an important outcome that achieves some other strategic objectives that you have in your urban chapter plan or high level. So if you're looking, I think maybe then the answer could be a carve out of that block of land, maybe from Frederick North, that becomes a business zone. That allows the council to retain its objective about avoid, because that would apply to other land.
Okay, thank you. I understand what you're asking for. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, team. Much appreciated. Mr. Street's been waiting patiently.
Today?
I think you're on tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Okay, I'll come back tomorrow. I'm sorry. I don't know how that happened, but you're on my schedule for tomorrow, Ms. Wallace.
Okay.
It's 10:10. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't recognise you in a completely different garb.
Oh, yeah. My name's Michael Clark.
Oh, that's why I didn't recognise you, Mr.
Yeah.
Clark.
I'm here standing in for Chris Street.
Oh, yes.
He gives you his apologies for not being able to turn up. He's got family problems.
So you're very welcome. You're here in support of a submission that was late, but we understand why it was late. We've followed a process. We've got a section 42A report from Ms. Turner, and so really over to you. I think the Ms. Turner is, I think, effectively saying you've got your relief by another route, but you tell us what your perspective is.
Right. Well, I think the best thing to do for starters is to just give you a little bit of background on what the Arthur's Point Protection Society is all about. It is, firstly and foremostly, it is not anti-helicopters. A lot of us are very keen outdoors people, and we are not out against the helicopters using the wilderness and the national park. But we have been formed very early on, somewhere around about the tail end of the 1990s, to protect the Arthur's Point residential area. At that time, there was not a lot of people there. We started off with an appeal for an application to a helicopter pad, which is still there. It's right beside Onsen's Pools, behind the framing studio, just across the road from the Swiss Bell Resort Hotel. We went into the process of appeal, and there was something like about 20 odd individual submissions put in at the early stages. We all went about the process of forming society, and we then went through the process of dealing with that one particular helicopter pad. Chris Street was the guy that really was the brains behind it. We ended up doing 5 separate appeals to the Environmental Court, and we won 5. And
my experience is you should quit while you're ahead. 5 out of 5 is not bad.
Yeah, we've carried on. We've been at this business with the helicopters since, like I say, sort of 95 was when all of a sudden the helicopters from Queenstown, Bob's Peak, through to Arthur's Point were really, really bad. Chris has asked me to put to you how it has affected our business, which is accommodation and it's also weddings, and there was another business there also. It's the Lavender Farm. They were severely affected too. We have learnt a lot over the years, and Chris wanted to point out to me that this is probably the longest standing dispute the council has for a small area just to do with noise from helicopters. When we went through this process of dealing with the this one particular pad, we then ended up having the helicopter industry coming back at us again in a sort of a back avenue way of changing the rules, so to speak, as far as measurement of sound. And then we ended up having a situation there where we had the helicopter standard NZ6807 imposed on us, and we learned a lot, and we ended up our last major appeal with the Environmental Court got it so that we have the protection for the whole district as it stands now, which is a 50 dBA LEQ 15 minutes. And this is a really good protection for everybody, and that you can effectively not land a helicopter within 200, 250 metres of anybody's house. And we really would like to see this continued on. All our information in regards to our struggles with the helicopter industry are listed with our website, which we have put up. It's called queenstown-noise.co.nz, and it has all the data. Everything that is to do with the hearings is all there. So if you've got any questions, please don't hesitate to go there. Chris Street also says he is available to answer any questions if you need be. Our personal property was subjected to noise on a regular basis starting around about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, where helicopters were flying from Bob's Peak to this helicopter pad beside Olsen Pools, and there were times there where there would be 5 machines in the air at any one time, and it actually drove me mad. I mean, I was at one stage there very much insane. I actually had a shotgun in my hands. Insane. And I know there was another guy there who had the Lavin farm. He was being subjected to the same sort of thing. Now, we're talking about 95, and this is when all of a sudden the tourist industry was taking off and the helicopters really had no control over them. We learned at a very early stage there that when it comes to helicopters, as soon as they're 500 feet above the air, you have no control over them. They are under the control of the CAA. So what we learned is that if we're going to have anything to do with protecting our environment, we have to take note of where these things land. And the last case that we were involved in, which we were acting as a, what do you call it, you join on to an appeal, you know what I mean?
274.
That's it. And we were to do with the Bob's Peak helicopter pad there. The council was representing Skyline, and those guys there wanted 16 flights. Actually, they wanted more than that, but in the end, they ended up with 16. The High Court turned them down, and they left them with just 4. Now, that's way up the hill there. You'd think it's miles away from everybody. It wouldn't affect anybody. But in the end, a very good decision by Judge Jackson, and they have got 4 a day. Now, what we would like to do as far as the Arthur's Point area is concerned is protect the environment as we have got it. We have got the helicopters going around the valley now. They're keeping well away from us. When we got those 20 submissions early on, there was no subdivisions in Arthur's Point whatsoever. And I've been told there is something like 300 apartments on the books now. I can't imagine the amount of noise that they would make if they were subjected to what we were subjected back in the 90s. Yeah, so we would very much like to keep our environment the way it is. And as far as the rural zone, you get down here, 464.5 and formerly airports. We would like to see that the people that live in the rural community are given the same protection as the people that are in the residential areas. And this business, Chris Street told me of a case there where he had a guy on the phone in tears in Makarora, where the council had granted a consent for a helicopter pad, and the neighbouring landowner, residential area, because of the way the the consent was granted, this property owner cannot build on his property. Now, that's just wrong. So, really, we are in a situation there where we have a reasonable amount of experience as far as this is concerned. And I'll just read you this. This is where we stand. And so it says, we will accept the same noise rules for Arthur's Point visitor area that apply to... Hold on. We will accept the same noise rules for Arthur's Point rural visitor that apply to the Arthur's Point low-density residential zone, which was agreed at court mediation in March this year between QRDC and APS and other parties. It's 40 LDN, 275 metres from the nearest property and so on. Now, the council's lawyers have agreed at a mediation in March for us to challenge the 50 LDN for the rural visitor zone. We probably will. APPS agreed to this to allow QLDC to resolve the appeals on all other zones. Read chapter 36, which advertises 50 LDN. We do not agree to any flights as a permitted activity. You know, we really do think that we need to protect our environment. And helicopters, unless you've really experienced them going over you on a regular basis, sometimes they hang in the air before they can land, get people out of the way, and they land. Very rarely do you see them turn around within 5 minutes. It's more likely 10. And then they're off again. So say sort of around about 12 minutes. 12 minutes at the most, 12, 15 minutes is one landing. They talk about a flight is a landing and a takeoff. And you know, for somebody to agree to 15 flights a week, you've only got to have all those flights compounded into one day and be relatively close to somebody's wedding, and their wedding's ruined. I mean, so I think we really should be looking in a situation where each individual application for a helicopter pad be assessed on its merits, and you know, keeping in mind where the next door neighbours are, keeping in mind lots of the flight path. You know, it takes a wee while for them to get up 500 feet. Yeah. That's basically all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Now, what the council officer said is that you asked the same zoning as in the rural visitor zone. The rural visitor zone doesn't exist anymore. It's been replaced by a medium density zone. The council officer has recommended that part of that area be rezoned high density. And in those two zones, medium density and high density, informal airports, which will include a chopper pad, are prohibited.
Good.
You can't make an application. The only exceptions are for emergency landings, rescues, and firefighting.
Cool.
So the question is, does that solve your problem if they can't make an application?
Absolutely, yeah. Too right. Yeah. So that's the residential area that's sorted out, so yeah, Arthur's Point should be pretty good, yeah.
Well, that sounds like a good news story.
Sounds like a winner, isn't it?
Any questions?
No, thank you. None for me, sir.
No, thank you for coming along.
Thank you for coming
Great.
Along.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry you had to wait so long.
Thank you.
Many thanks.
that.
Yeah.
We find Mr. Milne. Oh, well, well, he's not due until 22. So we'll have a break and